We're in the book of Daniel, and chapters 5 and 6 I'd like to get into today. The book of Daniel, of course, the last time we had it here was before the feast, and in chapter 3 and 4 at that time. The first six chapters, outside of chapter 2, which of course is the beginning of prophecy there, the others have to do with faith and God's work and showing his people that even though that they were suffering the punishment of captivity, that those who would turn to him, he still was with them and protected them and saved them even in the what was then the greatest empire of the world and of that time and age. He also revealed to those who had come in that he was the one and only true God, and that their gods were nothing compared to the one and only true God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and of course of Daniel as well. Here in chapter 5, before I get into chapter 5, and I'm going to have to let this kind of hang over the edge here, I have a commentary I'm going to use here during this study today. It's the Expositor's Bible Commentary, which is a good conservative commentary, by the way. And if any of you are looking for one, of course, take a little bit of change out of your pocket to pay for it. you probably want to have to buy it on time, but it really is a very good commentary. What I want to start with is to give you some historical background, because in chapter 5, we begin with the story of Belshazzar. Now, we have skipped a number of years from chapter 4. Chapter 4 is when Nebuchadnezzar was alive, remember? And he was, because he spent either 3.5 or 7 years, whichever, it's still a question mark on what was the actual length of time that he was insane, and before he came back to office. Now, when we come to chapter 5, Nebuchadnezzar's dead. He has died. And Belshazzar is the king here in Babylon. And so what are we looking at in time that has gone by? Well, let me read some of the history here, background, so tell you what's been happening in between chapter 4 and chapter 5. Now, remember, Daniel didn't accumulate and put the book that's called Daniel together until close to the end of his life. And it's not the book of Daniel is not in chronological order of his life or of the events of his life. Nebuchadnezzar had died in 563. Now, it's, you know, you want to keep dates a little bit in mind. Jerusalem fell, the temple was burned in 586. Daniel and his three friends were among the first invasion and captivity that was taken, which would have been around 605 to 604 that year, that he was taken as a young, late teenage boy, very early 20s at the most, to Babylon. Well-educated, wise, and especially wise because of their faith and their trust in God. It's interesting, you read nothing about Daniel to speak of in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah never went into the captivity, but he was there at the final destruction of Jerusalem and the burning of the temple in 586. So it would have been about 18, 19 years from the time that Daniel was taken into captivity until Jerusalem was finally sacked and the temple burned, okay, and it came to an end. During all that time, Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babylon. He is the one who defeated the Assyrian Empire and destroyed Nineveh in 612, about 7, maybe 8 years before Daniel and his three friends were taken captive to Babylon. And he's called the King of Kings, remember, in chapter 2. That is, Nebuchadnezzar was. That's how Daniel addressed him in that sense, in that way. Not in the sense of you think of King of Kings today as being Jesus Christ, but he was King of Kings at that time because there was no other physical king that could in any way be equal to him. And so that's why you hear that at that time. Well, anyhow, Nebuchadnezzar then died in 563. Well, how long ago? That would have been over 40 years after Daniel and his three friends had been taken to Babylon, right? So they knew of Nebuchadnezzar, and they served Nebuchadnezzar for most of the remaining 40 years of his life until his death. It's interesting, as you'll see here, because where is Daniel at the time of Belshazzar. As you'll see, Belshazzar has never heard of him. So notice the time here. All right, Nebuchadnezzar died in 563. He was succeeded by He was succeeded by his son, whose name was Evil-Merodach. Now you may think Evil-Merodach. You have to understand that's their language, not our language. Even though it translates evil, it doesn't mean evil. What his name meant was man of Marduk, the god Marduk. That's how he was named. Evil-Merodach translated means man of Marduk. All right, so Evil-Merodach, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, followed him, who released the captive Jewish king Jehoiachin from prison and gave him an honorable place at his court. Now, I'll just refer you to it if you want to look at your own, at the 2 Kings 25 and verses 27 through 30, which is the very end of 2 Kings. 2 Kings only has 25 chapters, and the last verse of it is verse 30. And guess what? The writer of 2 Kings talks about Jehoiachin, who had been taken captive and had been there for many, many, almost 40 years in captivity. When Nebuchadnezzar died, his son brought him out of the prison, set him at the table, and provided for him. Now, why? I don't know, but he did for the rest of his life. Now, 2 years later, Evil-Merodach, though, was assassinated by his brother-in-law, General Nergal, N-E-R-G-A-L, Nergal, protect the king. Of course, he didn't. He killed the king, who had served under Nebuchadnezzar when Jerusalem was destroyed in 586. So this man who served under Nebuchadnezzar, 2 years later after his son Evil-Merodach becomes the king, he kills Evil-Merodach to become king. So Nergal, to put it short, died just 4 years later in 556. And his son, whose name I can, Labashai-Marduk, if I said that right, who succeeded him, well, guess what, was murdered 9 months later in the same year. This revolt placed its leader, Nabonidus, in control. Nebo is exalted on the throne. Now, he does not seem to have been related to the royal family by blood, but apparently he married a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar in order to legitimize his seizure of the throne. All right, let me just walk through this real quickly so we get down here to Belshazzar. Guess who Nabonidus' son is? Belshazzar, okay? Belshazzar is the number two man. He's not the number one man. And for interpreting the handwriting on the wall, I will give to the one who can do that the number three position in the throne. Well, why not number two? Well, because he was number two. Who was number one? Nabonidus, okay? All right, Nebuchadnezzar dies in natural causes, 563. His son, Evil-Merodach, takes his place. 2 years later, he's assassinated by one of the generals who had served under Nebuchadnezzar. That man did not last but 4 years, and he dies. His son takes his place, and he is overthrown in a revolt by Nabonidus 9 months later. So Nabonidus, who was not related to the royal family and Nebuchadnezzar's family, but he married one of his daughters, and to make it look legitimate that he should be on the throne. And he was. Did he rule out of Babylon? No. He, for whatever reason, is not known exactly in history, spent most of his time ruling over the area of Edom and North Arabia. Some have thought in the city of Tema. Now, Tema was the name of one of Esau's sons. And the area of Edom was apparently at that time still existed, the Edomites did, in northern Arabia. Now, some think maybe Nabonidus was there because of his health, dry climate and all that, and hot. Of course, I thought Babylon was pretty much that way too, but maybe I'm wrong. In the summer it is, apparently. But so he was there, and he had his son Belshazzar in charge back home in Babylon. Okay, so that brings us then down to 539 B.C. All the way from the death of Nebuchadnezzar in 563, now we come down to Belshazzar in 539. I said that Nabonidus overthrew the son of Nergal, the general, and that took place in 556. That is true. So Belshazzar has been here in charge in Babylon from 556 to 539, where the story picks up in chapter 5. So what do we have there? We have almost, just under, 17 years have gone by, right? 17. Where's Daniel been? Where's the three friends of Daniel been during this time? Remember, Daniel served under Nebuchadnezzar for being able to interpret the dreams or give the interpretation that God gave to him to give to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so here we see that Belshazzar now in chapter 5, we have skipped in time. How old is Daniel, by the way? He is somewhere in his early 80s when we get down to 539, the end of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 5 is the end of the empire. It ends that very night when Darius the Mede and his troops come in and kill Belshazzar. Okay, so for all these years, 17 years after, Nebuchadnezzar died in 563, and so you have 24 years have gone by since the death of Nebuchadnezzar, whom Daniel served. And Daniel, even though he's forgotten by all the different ones who have come and gone, some by assassination and others and all of that, Belshazzar's been here, though, under his father's protection, you might say, for at least 17 years. Now we come to chapter 5. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. And while he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and the silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar. Now, his father was not Nebuchadnezzar. So why would it say that? Well, we have to understand how the customs are of that day and age. Who did Nabonidus marry to legitimize his taking the throne as number one? The daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, right? That is the connection, but it's not by blood. And so that's how he could be called when it says here, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his companions might drink from them. So he claimed that, whether or that was claimed of him, because of the marriage of his father to the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. he was already alive. His father did not sire him, as far as we know, as a son by the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. That Belshazzar, in other words, was already alive, had already been born. Now, verse 3. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem. When were they taken? Well, back at the last invasion was 586. In the invasions prior to 586, you go back to the book, I believe, of Jeremiah, you will find that a lot of the things were taken out of the temple back to Jerusalem, Babylon. So it wasn't just all taken at one time. But the final desecration and everything was in 586. Now, there is an important lesson here that God is going to show here of respect to him. And because these had been consecrated, these particular vessels, they had not been in any way desecrated by Nebuchadnezzar or those who followed Nebuchadnezzar until we get to Belshazzar. And for some reason, he's going to come out here at this big feast of Marduk and other gods and bring out the, by the way, those things, somebody told me they were here taken from that Jewish temple over there. We'll drink our wine out of them. Well, remember the story, what is it, Uzzah, who touched the ark going up to Jerusalem and what happened to him? And the same, you might say, is what you see right here. There are certain things that... you do not show disrespect and dishonor to God. And if people and their even if they're ignorant, as this man was, God is going to show him and show the rest of them around here that I'm alive, I'm in charge, and you do not blaspheme my name. You do not blaspheme that which is made holy and had been consecrated, which had been in Jerusalem. Verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood, and stone with what? The vessels taken from the temple. And so here they're using those things to praise their silly gods that don't exist. Verse 5, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him. I'm sure they did. So that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other in absolute fear. Now you see somebody, or see a hand without a body attached to it over here writing on the wall. And, you know, what was written on the wall stayed there. And here you have a hand that's able to imprint into the stone wall writing. And, you know, you would think that, well, the resistance to your finger. Well, no, you have the hand of God here that's writing and putting it right in there as little as sand when it is solid stone. And and there's no body attached to it. Well, no matter how much he'd had to drink, that certainly got his attention. Verse 7. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, obviously, he was petrified when he saw what was happening, and something like that was so unnatural. If anybody can tell me exactly what that is, and I can see that you that indeed you're telling me the truth, that's your reward. That's how important it was to him to find out. You know, if anyone else knew, you would think they would be very careful. They wouldn't tell the truth, would they? Because they would fear that they would be killed for telling what's going to happen to you, King. But you'll notice as we go on later in the chapter, Daniel does not fear that. You really see the working of faith, not only in chapter 3 with the fiery furnace, but here in chapter 5 and 6, the lion's den, that we see with Daniel. And really, what is it telling us here? When you think about this, why is this even here? Why did this even happen? It was for us. And generations later that it's recorded for us, what? Because the Jewish people, frankly, are going to be in captivity for the next 2,500 years. Persecuted all over Europe. Persecutions over the centuries in Europe leading up to even to the Holocaust of the Second World War. But what does it show here? Here's a man who put God first and truly turned to him in total humbling of himself. Did God say, well, when the Messiah comes, I'll save you? No, to anyone, and this is a thing that many people have never seen or recognized, if they will turn in faith and confidence to God and trust in him, even in this situation, I will deliver you. I will deliver you. And these people, there was only four that we know of, Daniel and his three friends here in the book of Daniel, but obviously this is for us. Now, there is going to be a time of great tribulation coming in the future. And there are some people who are going to, of course, not go into a place of safety, as the Bible talks about before it begins, but who will come out of great tribulation. As it says, was it chapter 14? Or I get it mixed up. It's either chapter 7 or 14 of Revelation. An innumerable multitude that will come out. Well, there has to be some faith there for them to survive and to come out of great tribulation. They come out in faith. All right, let's go on here. Verse 8, now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Now, why couldn't they read it? I'm not quite sure if it was because of the, most likely it was in a cuneiform writing, but they apparently could not understand or see what it meant. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change in any way whatsoever. Now, she wasn't there drinking from these vessels, was she? But she has heard about the story. And the queen, I'm going to pick up here a note on her, if I can get to it. The queen mother, that's who she is the queen mother, is what the commentary points out. The queen mother referred to Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father. Strictly speaking, Nabonidus was his true father, but on the reasonable supposition that Nabonidus had married a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar to legitimize his usurping of the throne, Nebuchadnezzar would have been the grandfather of all his daughter's children and so on that she would have had. That's not the comment I want. I want the thing on the queen mother concerning this. I've got a number of notes here I wanted to... I don't see it on the page that I was looking for, the explanation here about the queen mother coming in here to tell him. The point is, though, that she did come in. She was not obviously a part of the big party going on. And so she gives him that advice. Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, okay, that I did have the right one because the comment goes with verse 11 here. Your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Now, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. He'll tell you what it's about. Well, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father, the king, brought from Judah? Verse 14, I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Yes, and why? Because he was a person yielded to God. We'll see as you go into chapter 6, which is not very far after chapter 5 in time. What did Daniel do during all those years? He prayed 3 times a day. And that tells us something. He was a person very close to God. He knew he had to be in the circumstances that he was in. He was a person uncompromising with the idolatry that was around him in Babylon. And yet he had a very good spirit. He was a very positive individual. When it talks about a good spirit, do you think he went around with a sad look? No, he was an individual with a very optimistic and positive look, because he knew, even though he was here with his people in Babylon, and he would probably never go back, that his life was in God's hands. And he was there, and there was a purpose, and God was using him. And so he accepted. You know, remember the in Philippians 4, is it? Verse 11, I believe it is, where Paul said, whatever state I find myself in, I am content. And he learned to be content. And because of his faith and his trust here in God for all things. All right, verse 15. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you, and that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Well, Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. He wasn't like the astrologers. He wasn't in it for the money. And you can keep the reward. As you'll see later, it's given to him even though he did not want it. It was bestowed on him by the king. Verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory, and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Now he's reminding Belshazzar of something that by this time is over 30 years old, maybe close to 40 years when this actually happened during the lifetime of Nebuchadnezzar. We don't know exactly the year that this took place. Verse 20, then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. Well, this is going back and reviewing to Belshazzar, because Daniel already knows what this is all about. And he is telling Belshazzar leading up to this, because you didn't learn the lesson from your, I guess we have to call it your father, grandfather, great-grandfather, whatever it would actually be. And yet you knew about some of these things. Verse 22, but you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all of this. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. They do not exist. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Well, this is really getting pretty serious here before the king. And the king is sitting there and he's taking all of this in. Normally, you don't talk to the king like that. Now, this king was going to listen. When he saw that hand over there writing, and Daniel has no fear, and he is going to tell it as it is to the king. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, God, and this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written. Many, many, Tekel, Upharsin. This is, of course, very interesting. You have many, many actually it's taken from a mina, M-I-N-A, and it meant 50 minas or 50 shekels from the verb to number. The verb to number, this is from the Persian language, apparently. And it's interesting what it adds up to here when you look at it in Hebrew coinage, because it is apparently a Persian coinage, but translated or transposed into Hebrew. It adds up to kind of an interesting number. I'll tell you how it adds up here. Many, many, 50 shekels, that's 100. And then tekel is 1 shekel. And then upharsin actually is half of the 50 shekels, or 25. So you got 50, 50, and 1 is 101, plus 25 is 126. Now, what's interesting about the shekel is that it takes 20 gerahs. 20 gerahs represents 1 shekel. Now, if you multiply 20 gerahs times 126 shekels, you get a number that is 2,520. Now, the only other place in the Bible you see that number is in Leviticus chapter 26, Is it three times or four times there where it talks about, and I will increase your punishment seven times more. And that likewise there, the Hebrew word Sheva, S-H-E-V-A, is referring not just to intensity, but also to time. We wondered for a long time in the church, well, what does this mean? Because we know the year that Babylon fell. It's historical. It even tells you right here in the commentary, 539, that's a known year, and the fall of 539 is when the kingdom fell. And if you come forward 2,520 years and then add 1 year when you cross from B.C. to A.D., you come to 1982. So what happened in 1982? I don't know. So obviously there was something else, and maybe even though you can add that up and come up with that number, apparently it doesn't mean anything here as far as the future. It does mean something at that time as far as what the words themselves meant. And so let me go on here and we'll see this. But it's interesting how it was put up there. It was an enigma to the to Belshazzar, to the astrologers, to the soothsayers. They couldn't figure out what do you mean, many, many tekel upharsin. Well, verse 26, this is the interpretation of each word. Many, God has numbered. I think your center margin might show you that too. Your kingdom and has finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. and that's exactly what happened that night. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. You might say short-lived, because that very night, as it goes on, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, let me explain some things here. The Greek historian Herodotus of the 3rd century wrote about the fall of Babylon. It's very fascinating. I've got actually Herodotus' book at home, but what I want to read is, I can read it right out of the commentary here because they quote from it. how that it was, the Babylonian Empire was under siege by Cyrus and his forces. And they had defeated the Babylonians almost a year before in a major battle. The Babylonians withdrew back into the city of Babylon, which was impregnable for the Persians or anybody of that age to be able to get into. Herodotus, excuse me, Herodotus describes the walls being 300 feet high. And wide enough at the top. Now, that's on him. I mean, even 100 feet is an incredible when you look straight up. At the top, you could have two chariots beside each other riding around it. It was like a 15-mile square city with the Euphrates River going through it. And, of course, you couldn't come in by the river because you'd drown. It was too deep and everything and too swift. Inside, you had the second wall by the river. And nobody's going to get through the first wall, but if they perchance did, then they got to get through the second wall to get into the city. And, of course, the Temple of Marduk and the and Nebuchadnezzar and now Belshazzar's palace and everything is in the center of the city. Before I'll break into this to read a little bit, but what happened the year before in the battle in which Cyrus the Great did defeat the Babylonians in open battle. He lost his beautiful white stallion in the Euphrates River. And he decided that he was going to tame that river, that he was going to conquer that river after he lost his prized horse. So he had his men begin to dig canals. And then it began, I guess, at some point when they were doing this, to lower the level of the river, they realized, if we lower this river, we could probably go in underneath those walls with a small force. which is what they did at night to be able to get in, while the Babylonians had no idea what was going on and got to the palace, killed Belshazzar, and opened the gates. Let me read Herodotus on this. Hereupon the Persians, who had been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, and thus got into the town. Had the Babylonians been apprised of what Cyrus was about, or had they noticed their danger, they would never have allowed the Persians to enter the city, but would have destroyed them utterly, for they would have made fast all the street gates which gave upon the river, and mounting upon the walls along both sides of the stream, would so have caught the enemy as it were in a trap. But as it was, the Persians came upon them by surprise and took the city. Owing to the vast size of the place, the inhabitants of the central parts, as the residents at Babylon declare, long after the outer portions of the town were taken, knew nothing of what had chanced. But as they were engaged in a festival, continued dancing and reveling until they learnt the capture, but too certainly. So here the outer city has fallen. They've come through the gates and everything. I mean, they've penetrated the whole thing, and they're still partying in the center, and had no idea of what has. Don't you realize? You know, it's like in the Titanic or something. You know, a lot of them didn't realize what has happened. Well, we felt this bump out there. Now, well, everything's fine. That bump just sliced open like a can opener the hull of the ship. Well, here they are. They're having a great time. And, you know, like a New Year's Eve celebration or something all night long. And you got Persians coming through the streets, and they got to the palace and killed the king right away. A couple other things we'll see here as we look at the end of chapter 5 and go into chapter 6. You might recall when we began this, most of your liberal theologians do not believe that Daniel wrote this book. They believe some other person wrote it at the time of the abomination of desolation in 168 BC, 168 to 165, because they don't believe that the miracles and the things that he prophesied could have happened in advance and then fulfilled later. No, they're so exact and so in everything that he predicted that it must have been somebody writing about it after it was fulfilled, after it actually happened. So to do that, they have a little problem they have to work out. He talked about four kingdoms, didn't he? Now, all of us here, we know what the fourth kingdom is. It's Rome, right? We have no problem with understanding that. But Rome is not mentioned in the book of Daniel, is it? There are only three that are mentioned: Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. So since the Roman Empire did not come into existence until 100 years after the abomination of desolation in 63 BC, then who are the four kingdoms he's talking about? Well, they say that the second kingdom is the kingdom of Media. But actually, if you look at the content of the book, that's not true. Because we see here, let me read the end of verse 31. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. All right, hold your place there and go over to chapter 9, verse 1. Chapter 9, verse 1. So Darius the Mede now is over Babylon, right? He was 62 years old when he received the kingdom. You notice it says he received the he received the kingdom. Well, if you receive it, who did he receive it from? Look at chapter 9, verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. Now, if the Medes were by themselves a separate kingdom from the Persians, he wouldn't have been made the king. Somebody over him made him the king of the Chaldeans, and that person was Cyrus the Great. The prophecy in Isaiah 44 into Isaiah 45 was that Cyrus would go through the Golden Gates. And he did, not literally, he did later, but it was through using Darius the Mede. We will also see as we go into chapter 6, the law of the Medes and the Persians. Persians are obviously in charge. Otherwise, if the Medes are the second kingdom, then it would be the law of the Medes, not the law of the Medes and the Persians. And history does attest to the fact that, yes, the Median Empire was subject to the Persians. It was a part of the great Persian Empire that lasted for several hundred years, down to about the time of Alexander the Great, around 323 BC, excuse me, I think it's when the Persians were defeated. All right, let's take a look now here at chapter 6. So we don't have anything that we can put stock in concerning the many tekel upharsin. If there is some meaning to it, it will have to be revealed to us later. We can add up the coins and shekels and gerahs, but it doesn't seem to tell us anything when we do. Not like you'll see when we get to chapter 9 and the 70 weeks prophecy. And by the way, just get ahead of myself, it won't be in this study, but one thing about the authors of the this particular commentary, they recognize exactly the year of the 70 weeks prophecy beginning in 457 by Persian records. And you know what else they recognize? The actual exact beginning of Christ's ministry in the fall of 27 AD. They recognize that and they put it's right there. And it's very interesting. I just say that because sometimes people think, well, that was just the church came up with that. No, it isn't. Others recognize and see that too. I've got it right here in writing. And it's in the introduction to the book of Daniel as well as Daniel chapter 9 when you get to it. Let's go in here to get chapter 6 in real quickly, and because I want to get next time, because when we come back for the next one next month, we're going to begin, and the rest of Daniel is prophecy. 7 through 12 is solid prophecy. And that's what the critics, the frankly unbelievers, they cannot grasp. And it doesn't matter how much evidence you show from the book of Daniel that the book of Daniel indeed was inspired and it was written in the 6th century. You know, I'm reminded, if you might recall, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, Luke 16. At the very end of the chapter, which is down verses 27 through 30, I believe it is, the rich man said to the Lord, well, I have five brothers, and go show them and that they might repent. And the Lord said, well, they have Moses. And he said, but if they see one coming from the dead, who's resurrected from the dead, then they will believe. And Christ said, if they have not listened to Moses, if they don't believe Moses, they won't believe one who comes from the dead either. And it got me thinking about whether you're talking about the critics of the Bible who just do not want to believe and they do not want to submit to God in any way or to believe that miracles took place in the supernatural. It doesn't matter if one from the dead came to them, they still would not change their mind. It doesn't matter how much evidence, how much proof. It's like these people that absolutely they have the philosophy that they want to believe that you came from a little cell that of chemicals that came together in the sea. It doesn't matter how absolutely incredibly ridiculous that is, how much evidence you show that they have no evidence. And if you want to insist upon it, very simple. With all that we have today, let's see you duplicate it and make it live. Doesn't matter. You can take all the great names of science, whether it's Richard Dawkins or Gould and others. You can point out that there is no evidence in the fossil record of transitions or anything else. But they're going to believe it's a philosophy that they want to hold to. It is not science. Science is empirical evidence, which they do not have. But what they believe in is materialistic philosophy, and that there can be no supernatural. Well, I only point that out because even here, when you come to the Bible, you have people that dedicate their whole lives trying to discredit the Word of God. That's their whole life. The big names in the intellectual world, academic world, and if one came to them from the dead, they still would not change their mind. I mean, people get so entrenched. Anyhow, that's aside. Let's go back, chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might have account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So Daniel, obviously, his reputation has gone from Belshazzar right over to Darius the Mede. And he is looked upon, as we see in this chapter, with great favor by Darius the Mede. And then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Now, that's what we want to have, is an excellent spirit. And that's what Christianity, and that's what Jesus came to give to us, that we might all have an excellent spirit, even in trials, going through very difficult things in life. Did Daniel have trials? Most certainly he did, but he stayed close to God, as you'll see here. And that really was what the difference was. It wasn't Daniel doing it just for himself. It's that excellent spirit came to him from the one he spoke to every day. Verse 4, so the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. He was faithful to the government and both of the Babylonians and now to the Persians, and they couldn't find anything. They wanted to get rid of him. You know what was missing in the Persian law? There was no law against monotheism. There was no law against it. And he was perfect in his dealings. He was loyal to the king, and you could worship one God. There was no law against worshiping one God in the Persian realm. All right, so here they come up. Satan is clever. Verse 5, then these men said that we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, King Darius, live forever. And all the governors of the kingdom, of the administrators and satraps, counselors, advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Well, of course, it didn't dawn on Darius what this is all. You know who's not here? Daniel. Of course, they would come to the king with Daniel out doing the king's business somewhere. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. Again, if the Medes were the second great kingdom, as people who try to, who do not want to admit that Rome is the fourth kingdom, so they have to have a different second kingdom, they come up and they say the Medes. No, if the Medes were independent of the Persians, it would be the law of the Medes, not the law of the Medes and the Persians. And the second one here, Persians, are obviously over the Medes. And in chapter 8, where you have the goat with the two horns, did you notice that one horn is longer than the other? They're not equal. And, of course, that's the Medo-Persian Empire, which, what? Comes along another one with one horn, Alexander the Great, the Greco Empire, to disperse or to conquer the Persian Empire. All right, coming back here. So therefore, King Darius signed the decree. Verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, so word got to him, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days that he had been doing that. Now, maybe he got that from David, who prayed three times a day, Psalm 55 and in verse 17. That's possible. Mr. Armstrong brought this up at Feast of Tabernacles years ago in Big Sandy, Texas, and he said to brethren, do you know why he did that? Because he had to, in the way that he could express it. he made a good point. And he realized the situation he was under and how much he needed to be close to God. And, of course, pointing that out to us back in those years and how important it was to us, too, not just only to Daniel. These men, verse 11, assembled, found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. By the way, didn't it say in the upper room, showing they had a two-story house, didn't he? Second room, floor. And they went before the king, verse 12, spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? Well, the king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decrees that you have signed, but makes a petition three times a day. All right, the king is quite troubled, and he heard these words and was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, looking for some way out of this. He labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. And then these men approached the king and said to the king, no, O king, apparently under that law, you have to carry it out by sundown. And so, O king, that it is. And interesting, he is under the law of the Medes and the Persians. And he is a Mede. He is under the Persians and under, really, the Persian law. And which is, of course, you have, where's Cyrus? Well, Cyrus did later come to Babylon, but he spent more of his time at the capital of Persia, which was Susa. Susa is southeast of the ruins of Babylon today in what is Iran. And that was the actual Persian capital. there's a lot of things I'd love to see over there, but it's kind of risky. And anyhow, coming back here, verse 15, then these men approached the king, and finally, let me read it all. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Can't change it. The king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now, he must have known something about Daniel's past and as well. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. In other words, if it's broken, he's broken out. Remember how Pilate had a seal put over the stone of Christ, and that if that was broken meant that somebody had gotten in to take the body? And, of course, the Roman guard, all of that was put there to secure the tomb. And this is to secure so that he does not escape from this den. Verse 18, now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No musicians were brought before him. Also, his sleep went from him. he was quite concerned, obviously, here. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouth so that they have not hurt me. And now, this is not a young Daniel. This Daniel now is probably 80 to 83 years of age in there. And because I was found innocent before him, and also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. So the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. Interesting. He believed in his God. He trusted in his God, and he was delivered. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Now, an interesting point in the commentary, why all the family? Well, one of the reasons was because obviously the ones who were perpetrators would be thrown into the den, but if you allowed any of the family members to survive, they may then plot to assassinate the king in revenge. And that is one possible. Another one is that they're just plain kind of ruthless when it comes to life. Verse 25, then King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders, and in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Now that was extremely impressive to this man, and very impressed with Daniel's Daniel served. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Cyrus the Persian was the one who was overall, the shorter horn was Darius the Mede. And he had spent most of his time in control and overseeing Babylon. Cyrus did not, although he did come to Babylon, but he did not stay there or reign out of Babylon. He reigned out of Susa or Shushan in Persia. We'll stop there and we'll begin to get into some of these prophecies, especially chapter 7 is quite a meaty chapter, in the next Bible study.